Welcome to episode 84 of the Real Feedback Podcast. This episode is sponsored by W Lloyd Services. For all your building and landscaping works across the southeast of England, they offer quality services at quality prices. If, like me, the idea of personally tackling home improvements makes you cry into your breakfast, it's professionals like W Lloyd Services who you need when it comes to home and office improvements or building from scratch. Call 07949 380 775 for your building and landscaping needs. Are you sitting down? Are you a movie fan? Because my guest knows movies. The delightful Pamela Olch has worked as script supervisor on films such as Long Intake of Breath, Cheech and Chong's Up in Smoke, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, Pretty in Pink, Planes, Trains and Automobiles, Blow, The Big Chill, Strange Days, Showgirls, Miami Vice and The Cable Guy, and worked with Jack Nicholson, Steve Martin, John Candy, John Hughes, Joel Schumacher, Paul Verhoeven, Catherine Bigelow, Jack Lemmon, Michael Mann, Johnny Depp, Brad Pitt, Angelina Jolie, Jim Carrey, and Ben Stiller, and talks about all of those projects and people right here. Check out realfeedback.co.uk for all links to episodes and social, but who cares about that when my chat with Pamela is lined up and ready to go? Strap in, the wonderful Pamela has so much to tell. This isn't an interview, this is a conversation. This is Real Feedback. That's very, very prompt. I'm impressed.
That's a script supervisor for you. You know, right. Very precise about everything. Yeah.
So whereabouts are you? I'm glad. Well, I got the time right. That's a good start. So
Yes. I'm sitting in it's in my office. I live in Paso Robles in California, which is sort of halfway between San Francisco and Los Angeles. Retired up here from LA, which is where I lived, obviously, for so many years. We lived in Burbank because that was like the center spot for movies being made. You know, we were close to all the studios and it was easy to travel from there too. And we had a townhouse. We retired up here and just got a nice big 4-bedroom house so I can have my own office, my own space, because I'm always used to it. And
I'm still building up to that. My office is also, well, it's our old dining table, but we just got a kitchen extension, so there's a new table in there. So this is kind of now my office. I'm taking it for now.
But, what part of London do you live in?
I'm in North London in Enfield, which is
Enfield. Okay,
it's kind of near Tottenham, Wood Green. Because you're West Hampstead, weren't you? Going by what Nicholas said.
I was West Hampstead, yes, when we lived there, yeah. When Mum and my brother were still alive, I went back every single year. You can't always space your jobs. It was always a last-minute flight. You know, you pay the top price, you get in a plane, you go. And so, but then they both moved on, and now I just have a niece and two nieces, actually. One lives in Essex, one lives in Bow. So I go back every couple of years at least, so. Yeah.
One of the first things I wanted to talk to you about, and it's not with every guest I have to do this, but it's what is a script supervisor? Because if I have an editor on, everyone knows what an editor is. But script supervisor, what I thought it was, and then when I looked it up, are two completely different things. So if you could just explain a bit about what the job entails generally.
Okay, the job entails, okay, first and foremost, knowing your script inside out, backwards and forwards, so you can answer any question to any department at any time. But I really felt that the most important part of being a script supervisor is your liaison between the director and the editor. So you keep the notes that you keep track of every single shot that's made. You keep all the director's notes. The director says, oh, I love that line in that scene. Oh, you were really great in that. So you make a little note, send it to the editor. That's one of the things we do. I like to think that's a really important part because it helps the editor cut the picture together. Then, of course, is continuity. I always felt that we should be continuity supervisors rather than script supervisors. You know, how do you supervise a script? Apart from in-scene matching, which is important, but not quite as important as making sure that the picture flows. You have to know your screen direction. You have to know camera lenses to a certain extent. You have to know the sizes of everything because the picture has to flow. If you have people looking one direction in one shot and then a different direction in another shot, doesn't make it. And sometimes directors don't realize that they get so caught up in performances, which that is really their job, you know, is their performances more than anything else, is that I try and work with the director of photography and we try and sort of try and keep everything on track so that we have a picture that flows, that cuts together well, And apart from that, there's also the real continuity part of it, which is liaising. When I get a script, I break it down into days, nights, weather, you know, time of day and all that stuff. And then I work with wardrobe, makeup, hair, props. I mean, so we're all on the same page. Everybody has my breakdown. I do a breakdown. I give them all my breakdown. And if they have questions, they come to me. But mine tends to be the Bible because I've done so much work on it. Because they are actually responsible for their own continuity. I oversee it. If I see something that's drastically wrong or I see something, I'll call the press. Are you sure you got the right day on this? You know, and it's like, we try and do that actually before we hit the cameras, you know, so.
I mean, other than the director, it sounds like you've got the most, one of the hardest jobs because you're covering, I don't know, maybe producer kind of covers every aspect at some point, but it sounds like script supervisor covers every aspect, every corner of the crew.
We try and cover, we have to. That's our job. Our job is to cover everything. You know, it really is. It's, I think I missed something. And then, of course, they're the actors. You have to cue the actors. The actors have to know their lines. You have to be gentle with them sometimes. You know, a lot of actors don't like to be told they're saying the wrong lines. So you have to go up and say, did you really mean to say that? Or would you like to look at the script? You know, it's like... But that's the way we are. There's so much to do. It's an all-encompassing job. And how much of it you actually do depends on your director. A lot of directors really know what they're doing. You know, they've made films. They know the progression. They know what's happening. You know, whenever the director's talking to the director of photography, I'm always there standing with them so that we all know we're on the same page. And then there are directors whose sole focus is, I need to work with the actors, you know, the actors, the performance, that's what makes a movie. So at this point, I work even closer with the director of photography and we try and work out how to get the shots he sees or the shots that are needed to cover the scene so that when he goes into the editing room, he says, oh my God, why didn't I get a close-up of this person? Or, you know, why didn't I do this? Why didn't I do that? You know?
In some respects, it sounds like parts of it are almost being their conscience, sort of whispering in their ear, don't forget the close-up. And oh, yeah. Just to kind of prompt them to make sure that everyone is remembering everything that needs to be covered for the day. And you're kind of going around and mothering them almost.
Well, to a certain extent, that's true. But you try and keep a low profile. But if you see something that's happening, you know, you do whisper in a ear. That's what it is. You know, you go to the director and he whispers in your ear. He said, you think you're missing a shot here. Wouldn't it be nice if we got an insert of that because it'll help you transition to something else. You know, and you always make a suggestion. You never tell them. You always make a suggestion because that's how people respond best to you is make a suggestion. You know, it needs to come from them because most of our people we work with, directors, actors, they have egos, you know, and we have to respect that because they're smart people. They aren't there because, you know, they haven't done it. I mean, they're there because they have something creative about them or they're well-known actors. And I'm just a person to help them. You know, that's my job is to help.
I bet you're an expert in diplomacy.
You have to be.
Yeah.
You have to be. As I've told, because I've given talks at script supervisor at my union from time to time. And I say, you know, we're all well-trained. We all know what to do. We know the notes we need to keep. Sometimes, you know, so experienced, we're not terribly sure about the whole thing. But the most important thing is your demeanor on the set. You know, if you have a good demeanor on the set. And I maintain that's why I worked all these years, because I had a good demeanor on the set, you know. And it's very important, you know.
Well, that's just a little bit about your background then, because, again, going by what Nicola said, you emigrated to England from India at 15. Is that correct?
I was actually just 14 when
14.
We came over.
Right.
I was in boarding school in India for about 6 years. And they gave me a really good education, which was marvelous because I matriculated when I was 14. So came to England, then they sent me back to school. And I said, why am I going back to school? You know, I'm going to work. And as soon as I turned 15, I went to work. Wow. My mother had made me take a shorthand typing class in between the time I left school and the time the boat sailed. And so I did secretarial work for a long time, which in the long run really helped me because having shorthand when you're a script supervisor is absolutely invaluable, you know, because when actors start ad libbing and stuff, you know, you can get all that stuff. But that's, and so I started slowly, you know, my first job, I got paid £3.10 a week. I thought it was rich. And then I got bored with the everyday short head typing, and I went to work for a company called Television Mail, which was the industry magazine for television commercials at the time, which is where I met my first husband, who is Nick's father. And that was much more interesting because a little more creative because you were helping with articles and stuff that people brought in, and you helped with that. And then I had a child, and then we moved to New York for a year. And when I was in New York, I met a guy called Jay Cassine, who ran a company called Anglo Films, and he produced commercials. And he asked me if I would come and work for him. And I said, I'd love to, just for the year that I was there. And I learned a lot. And towards the end, I was like one of his high production assistants. Came back to London, got a job as a producer for Ann Lee Lacey, producing television commercials, which was really a lovely job. Because what I did, I worked with the production manager. We set up everything. Lee would come in from Los Angeles. He would direct, finish the casting, direct the commercial, run away. And I would work with the agency and through post. So I knew something about film. You know, we cut the commercial together. It was little, but at least that, you know, you have some knowledge that would be a film. And then I moved to Los Angeles, you know, because my whole life fell apart. Whatever. And that I then married, and he was a sound mixer. Well, was Nick's stepfather, and continued, but I just got jobs. I had his two children as well, so I was staying at home, so I was typing screenplays at home. I would just go pick up little cassette tapes, and I would type screenplays, and that's how I got my first job as a script supervisor, which segues into your next question.
Yes, it does, because Nick, because when Nick said, he said, up in smoke, and I thought, wow, what a, I mean, I saw it years ago. I thought, wow, that's a blast from the past.
It really is.
I mean, and what a film to start with. I mean,
it was hysterical, because all I was doing, I was sitting in this room with Cheech and Chong and the producer and the director and taking notes. They kept talking and I just kept taking notes. And then I would give it to Floyd, who was going to be the director, and he would write the screenplay. And I would go through the screenplay. And I kept finding mistakes all the time, you know, continuity mistakes and stuff. And make a long story short, the producer and director fell out. The producer decided he was going to direct the film. Tommy and Cheech continued writing, and I continued typing. And the time came when he got the financing, and he said, "Pam," Lou said, "Pam, do you want to be the script supervisor?" And I said, "Well, you know, I haven't really done a feature. You know, I know something about film." He said, "I haven't been," and he said, "I haven't directed anything." So we bonded there and then, and I jumped in, and it was a very fortuitous time because the unions were pretty closed at that time, but they had opened up for like a 3-month period because of some videotape agreement or something, and I managed to slide in, and that was my first film, and it was interesting. I mean, I kept notes like you wouldn't believe. the night before I started shooting, my husband had this wonderful lady who was an experienced script supervisor come in to give me a crash course on what I did during a feature, because, you know, notes, yes, this. And her mantra, which I have maintained all this time, is, what is it cut from, what is it cut to, and what's in the background? And those are really important continuity notes for a script supervisor. And based on that, and with a lot of note keeping, I jumped into that. And I did 3 features my first year.
Did you?
It was just, yeah, I did. Yeah, I mean, the next picture, I think, was Corvette Summer. I got a call from Paramount saying, come in, you're doing this picture. You didn't have to present CVs or resumes back then. Mm. You just got a call and you went to work. And that was a tough one because he was a first-time director. I was a first-time script supervisor. But I had this incredibly wonderful DP. His name was Frank Stanley, who's long gone. And I said, you know, I'm so inexperienced. We're all going to learn, and I'm going to teach you. He said, I'm going to help you. Anytime you have a question, you come to me and I'll help you. I learned so much from that man. I learned so much from the camera assistants in the camera department, who are so supportive. And then I went in to do American Hot Wax with Floyd Buttricks because I had been typing the screenplay for him and he loved me. So that was my first year, 3 features back to back.
Well, I imagine your second and third were very different to the first, because
totally different, yes.
If you thought up in smoke, thought, are all films going to be like this? Because also it's essentially a road movie as well.
Yes.
I know you went on to Well, I like to talk about Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, which is essentially another road movie for the most part. So I was wondering, how was it actually a road movie, or was it all filmed just around the streets of LA and shot to...
Oh, God, no. Oh, no, no, no. It was a road movie. We were chasing the snow. We were looking for snow. We couldn't find snow. Snowing in Malibu, back in Los Angeles, but we were in Chicago. We were in St. Louis. We'd get in, we'd say, okay, we're going to be here for a couple of days. Maybe it'll snow. We get a phone call the next morning. There's snow in Kankakee or somewhere like that. Everybody pack up, let's move. All jumped in, cut stuff together. Moved where there was snow. Shot where there was snow. Somebody else gives a report, there's snow somewhere else. It really was a road movie. We were all over the place. We really were, you know. It was hysterical, but, you know, as long as I had my script and I had what had to be done in front of me, it's not hard. You know, I mean, once you're a script supervisor and you know what you're doing, it's really not, it doesn't matter if you're jumping all over the place, you know, because you really, you know, you have a knowledge of what you need to do and how you need to do it, you know. And I think when you said what was the main challenge on that, it was keeping warm, because trying to find we'd be on these running shots on camera cars, and it was freezing cold, you know, because it's like, oh God, we were all bundled up, and it's like, yeah, it was,
With John Hughes films, whether he wrote and directed or just wrote them, there was quite a few that you worked on, sort of Ferris Bueller, Planes, Trains, Some Kind of Wonderful, Pretty in Pink. So
right.
How did it work? Once you did the first one, was it just that John or someone else on the production team liked your work, or were you with an agent that would work for the studio that kept giving you those films? Was it a personal relationship, or was it
Every show is a personal relationship for me. Never had an agent. I actually got my first picture with Howie Deutsch on Pretty in Pink. And that's another story.
I'm here for the stories.
The stories. You can cut them. You can
I want all of them.
Okay, so I was. I got a call from Lauren Shuler, who was the producer of Pretty in Pink, and she asked if Howie would really like to work with you, and she would you like to come in. And I said, I can't, because I'm busy. I've got a movie called Two Jakes. So she said, okay, I'm really sorry, maybe another time, da 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 da. So I prepped the Two Jakes. I did rehearsal with Jack Nicholson and Paul Evans and whatever. So we get to the first set the first day, and I'm running lines with Jack Nicholson. And somebody comes down and says, everybody just go have breakfast. Just go have breakfast. There's some discussion going on. We all went and had breakfast. It's okay, everybody go home. Went home. We came back the next day, and they said, the movie's shutting down. What had happened is that the director Robert Towne had not felt that Bob Evans was a strong enough actor to play opposite Jack Nicholson. And there had been, I'm sure there were more disagreements than I know about, but that was generally what we knew about. So here I'm out of work now. Movie shut down, that's it, gone. Next day I get a call from Lauren Shuler, who says, hey, I see Two Jakes shut down. You still want to do Pretty in Pink?
Yes, yes.
And I said, yeah, I'd love to go meet with Howie. So I went and met with Howie, and he said, I always wanted you. He said, you did The Big Chill. He said, you're the only script supervisor I ever wanted because of that movie. And I said, oh, that's terrific. And he and I went on to have this wonderful relationship. We worked, I think, 7 or 8 movies together. And became a good friend. He's a wonderful man. You know, I was funny enough, somewhat responsible also for him getting together with his wife. We were doing Some Kind of Wonderful, and Leah was one of the stars, Leah Thompson, who is Howie Deutsch's wife.
Have
two grown daughters who are both in the movie business. And I was hung out with him. We were hanging out in this trailer, and this boy said, she's really pretty. And I said, ask her out. No, what was she seeing in a guy like me? And I said, ask her out. It doesn't hurt. It doesn't hurt. And to this day, Leah Thompson, who was directing something, bumped into one of my stepsons somewhere. Literally probably 2 years ago. And said, oh my God, if it hadn't been for your mother, I would never have married Howie.
Oh.
So it just... so...
So there you go. You can add matchmaker to script supervisor jobs as well.
That's one of my stories. Okay.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, so when you Pretty in Pink, was John Hughes a known name then for what he now is known
for? I'm trying to think. I think he'd done Breakfast Club then. I don't remember. Yeah. He'd done Breakfast Club. I know because my husband was a prop master on Breakfast Club. I'm married to a prop master right now. But he was on the set because it's his movie, and he hired Howie's first-time director. Howie had done a lot of music videos, and John really liked his work, and that's how I think Howie got hired on this. And John was on the set almost every day. And so I met him, we talked, got together, he was very pleasant and stuff, and he said, "Would you like to do my next film, Ferris?" And I said, "Absolutely love to." So that's how I got the next job.
That's wonderful. That film is a particular favourite of mine. I mean, when I spoke to Nick, there was quite a few of his credits where I had to really control myself to not be too gushing and too nerdy. And when he mentioned you and I looked up your IMDb page, I just couldn't believe what I was looking at. So I'm appearing calm. But in my head, I'm not calm because.
Well, neither am I, because I'm not used to doing this.
Well, no, because a lot of your credits are what I grew up on these films, and to know that you were there, because I didn't realize script supervisor would be on set and be with the director and all the actors on these films. And when I think back to all the scenes in these films and think you were there for all of it, it's just incredible. What a wonderful career to look back on. So. Planes, Trains, Automobiles. Right. You've got Steve Martin and John Candy, who both at the height of their powers. Right. Was that, and I get it's work as well, but was it the joy that I would like it to, I'd like to think it was, or was it a kind of just this comedy tour de force and they were just...
That's a good question. I mean, it is sort of a comedy tour de force, but at the same time, actors, I mean, John Candy... the loveliest man in the world. He was so sweet and so nice, and wonderful to work with. Steve Martin was great. Steve is reserved. He's a very reserved person. When he's not on, he is really off. I mean, you know what I mean? When the camera's rolling, he's amazing. When he's sitting down, he sits in the corner, he does his crossword puzzle. He doesn't do, whereas John is, Mr. Sociable, we talk to everybody and stuff like that. And I didn't feel overwhelmed by them or overly impressed by them. They were a couple of great guys to work with, it was fun. It was.
I guess you'd already talked to Jack Nicholson by this point, so it's going to be hard anyone else to reach.
Well, something, I'm an older person, so I guess to me, I was more impressed with someone like with Jack Lemmon, when I worked with him and Walter Matthau and people. For me,
twice.
The first time I was left, twice. And the first time I was left alone in a room with Jack Lemmon, I mean, I was in with Howie because Howie, I went everywhere with him. I was there with the casting, I was there through everything, through his future movies, because I was almost like his right hand. And he left the room for a minute, and I'm sitting there with Jack Lemmon, and I'm just saying, what do I say to this man? What do I say to this man? And he was so gracious. He was so gracious, and he started to talk about the movies and stuff, and it was just, but that's an aside, but, he was more impressed. They were more impressed than Don Candy and Steve Martin. And I'd worked with Steve Martin before. No, maybe it was after. L.A. Story came after that.
Yes, that was sort of 91,
it came after. It came after. That came after. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. So sorry, I just don't remember.
No. It's been. So Ferris Bueller, there are lots of different things I could ask about that, but I was really intrigued with, from your perspective as a script supervisor, the stress of a huge public scene. So the carnival when he sings Twist and Shout, which I'm guessing wasn't 2,000 extras. It was a real...
It was a real.
A real
it
carnival.
It was a German something parade.
Yeah.
Yes, it was a German day parade, yeah. It really wasn't as hard as people think it was. We had multiple cameras. We sent them off in various directions to do shots of the crowds and shots of people reacting to the thing. I stayed with John with the A camera, and sometimes we had a B camera. And it was well choreographed. I think Kenny Ortega choreographed that. And it wasn't that hard. It was just I don't know. I didn't find it.
I wondered if it was a. Did you have to instruct the crowd? Okay, we're making a movie here. We're going to do a scene where our protagonist gets up and sings.
No, but no, the when the parade went by, we ran ahead. We had cameras. We were running ahead of the parade. You know, there was no stopping anybody. This was the German Day parade. You
So,
know, we had to keep up with them. You know,
right.
it was and they allowed us to put our float in, which had all our people on it, obviously.
Yeah.
And they it was an adventure, certainly. But
Yeah.
I didn't find that hard because the continuity in itself was not that complicated. You know, Matthew Broderick is a very disciplined actor, and whatever he does, he is theater trained, he's stage trained. So I never had to worry about continuity and stuff like that with him. He knew what he was doing, really knew what he was doing. And I have a lot of respect for him, and a lovely person to boot, you know. But it was entertaining, and we shot. You know, John Hughes shot film. He shot so much film. It was a lot of his movies were made in the cutting room. Because I have all my scripts from I have every script I've ever worked on. I still have them all, and I was just glancing through them because suddenly I've got interviews coming up, and it's like, and I realized how much more we shot than was actually in the script. You know, I mean, when we were doing Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, I think it was in one of the cafeteria scenes, and Steve and John are talking. John Candy and Steve are talking to each other, and they start ad-libbing, and cameras rolling. And back, you know, we didn't have digital back then. You had to stop and reload the camera. So 10 minutes ran out, and John would say, "Okay, reload right now, and you two continue." We did like three magazines of ad libs. You know, that was. It was a lot, and to keep track of all that was really hard. And I didn't know what he needed to cover or not, because, you know, then you've got to get coverage of this stuff if he wants to do it. At least they don't remember what they've said. So I had this little tape recorder. I plugged it into the back of the sound mixer's Nagra at the time, so I could get a complete recording of everything. And then I would sit in the back room with a typewriter and type out the key points of all
Oh,
the
brilliant.
conversations that they had. We could then do close-ups, overs, whatever you need to do. So
Yeah.
it was quite a challenge working for John, but that one especially, because we had two such talented actors working opposite each other, you know.
Was laughing on set ever an issue? I mean, imagine, you know,
Oh
those aren't
yes.
pillows.
Oh yes. Oh yes.
Just for you.
Oh yes, definitely. A lot of laughing on set, but it was
Yeah.
okay.
Because I guess people struggle enough with the actor corpsing, isn't it, is the term. It's people struggle enough with the actor's corpse in front of the camera. I imagine the crew would get told off for ruining a take if they're laughing behind the camera.
Well, we tried very hard not to, but John was pretty, you know, as long as it was just once, you know, once is okay. Just, you
Yeah.
know, just don't do it the second time. And by the time you've done it six times, nobody's laughing anymore anyway, you know.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I'm going to move up because, I mean, as I said to you, I gave you an idea of what films I wanted to talk about. I knew I wouldn't have time for all of them. So I've got to be picky and choosy. But Strange Days is a really, I love that film. It's a Kathryn Bigelow film. And obviously very different to John Hughes films. But it's quite a complex story. And you talk about when I realized that the continuity aspect of your job, I just thought, I bet this one seemed like it would be particularly difficult, but I don't know if that just made it difficult because you've got the it's the for people who haven't seen it, I don't even know what it's called, but the thing that people put in your heads that records what you see. So we cut from points of view of people. I just imagine it was quite difficult to keep up with. Have we got everything to so this makes sense for the viewer?
Yes and no, but because Catherine Bigelow had it all figured out. She was an incredible director. She had it all figured out. She was quite amazing. She knew exactly what she was going to do. She knew how she was going to do it. So it was not a problem for me. I have to give so much respect to her. She was an amazing director. And one of the questions was you know, being a woman director, did she get the respect? Yeah, people were just in awe of her. They really were, because she was a great director. She really was, yeah. And it wasn't that hard because she knew what she was doing, you know. But I can't remember. I mean, I'm sure there were suggestions I made, but she did listen. I was with her all the time. She really didn't like having me next to her all the time, and working through certain things together. And of course, James Cameron came to the set several times, and put his sixpence worth it. That's another story.
I've heard many James Cameron stories on this podcast. I mean, cause I was trying to think of what she'd done before that, and it was Point Break as well, but Near Dark and Point Break was obviously, so I guess she was already very much a known name.
But then, very intelligent woman. A very, very, very smart woman. Right. Yeah, a lot of respect for her.
But then a film like Showgirls with Sir Paul Verhoeven, every time I've seen any sort of behind the scenes of him, he's this crazy, but from a viewpoint of myself, this crazy tornado of a man who just seems to relish in the chaos of his sort of filmmaking. I mean, was he someone who was quite difficult to rein in? Oh, why was he?
Yes, yeah, that's him. That's okay. Yeah, he is. He was crazy, interesting man to work with. Though he got his own way. He wanted his own way, and he had absolute free rein. He had free rein on that picture. It went so far over budget; it was like insane. But everybody gave him what he wanted. You know, I mean, it's a. He loved his sex scenes, and as Paul always has done, you know, he's interesting to watch when he directs those. And I'm just not going to go into it. But if he wanted something, and it had to be what he wanted, I mean, he wanted, they had to drink champagne. It had to be Cristal champagne, none of your fizzy water or anything. So my husband, who was actually a prop master in the show, had to go and buy a case of Cristal champagne. You know, it's like, okay, you know, and of course half of it went to waste, half of it went into jugs because we couldn't, you know, and the crew in the back, of course, were happily drinking it when they could. So,
yeah.
but he had to, everything has to be really perfect for him. It had to be well done, and he was a little crazy, and you know, sometimes he didn't quite trust you. He questioned continuity a couple of times because we moved from one scene to the next, and I said, yeah, because Elizabeth Berkley she left, you know, the scene like this, and we shot the next part of it about 5 days later. And I said, don't forget to cross your arms. And he comes to me and says, I don't want her to cross her arms. I want to cross her arms. I said, but Paul, the shot before that, she had her arms crossed. I want to see it. So the video assist guy has to dig it out and put it back. And he looks at me and he gives me this big smile. He said, yeah, you're right. It's funny.
Wow. So that amount of detail you have to note down.
Oh, yes. Oh, God, everything. Yes. I mean, knowing, but the important thing about being an experienced script supervisor, it's not easy to go in when you is knowing what's important and what's not important. You know, when you exit a scene and you're going, the person has to enter exactly the same way. You know, you can't change anything, no matter how much the director loves you to. Within the scene, matching sometimes really goes awry because I'll give you an example. You have two people sitting at a table talking and they have a couple of glasses each, right? So the prop master sets it up and, you know, each one has so much in the drink. And they talk and they're talking and they're drinking and the scene comes to end and the director says, I don't want to cut, keep shooting. So we keep rolling. And now, of course, the levels are all wrong in the glasses, you know. And then he does another take. So sometimes you do three takes in a row and he cuts the best performances. The one performance, so when the glass levels are all wrong, it's out of your hands, you know, all you can do is say, you know, and the answer you got most of the time was, if they're watching that, they're not watching the movie. That's what I used to get. If says, okay, just thought I'd mention it, because the director has the final say. And, you know, and then you have these people who go online and nitpick about these little things, and they have no idea how the movie is being shot. They don't know, you know, that it's not a script supervisor who's screwing up. You know, it's a choice. A performance is better in one take, a performance is better in another. And as you said, they should be watching the performances, not the levels of the glass, you know, the lemonade in the glasses. So,
and it tends to be since the internet is where it all went wrong, wasn't it? When people can scan and moan and da 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 da.
Right, go back and forth. Yeah.
And really scrutinize it. The cable guy is so. When this came out, I remember everyone, Jim Carrey was huge, and everyone thought they were from my understanding, assumed they were getting another Ace Ventura or The Mask type film, but it was quite a, no, but it obviously wasn't. I mean, now this film's revered. A lot of comedians say this is their favorite Jim Carrey movie.
Really?
Yep. And it's not even that it's a cult classic in that, oh, it's a bit rubbish, but it's become this cult. It's seen as a good movie, and it was just a misunderstood at the time type of movie. So really? Ben Stiller directed this, didn't he?
Yes, he did. Yeah. Yes.
So I wondered how it was working on that film.
Well, it was interesting. Ben was a bit of a star himself, bless him. But, you know, a good director. And he sort of knew what he wanted. But, and we did what we could to help him. But, no, he knew it. And Jim Carrey was really very good and very expensive. This was the first movie that an actor had been paid over $20 million for a movie. Yeah, that was the thing. I remember because when I went in to see the production manager and I said, okay, this is how much I want. He said, oh, no, Jim Carrey's got all the money in this movie. We don't have anything for the crew. And I said, oh, thanks a lot. But at the same time, he was easy to work with. Jim was very easy to work with. I mean, there was a lot of improv, and don't want to go into it too much because I had problems with Ben Stiller, but that's my story.
No, that's absolutely fine.
But in
terms of Jim, yeah, though, and just working with people at the top of their A-list celebrity thing, do you approach them any differently the first time you meet them, or is it just an actor on the set? And you gauge, obviously, whether you need to approach them slightly differently throughout the shoot. But
you have to gauge. Some of them are extremely friendly and, you know, will come to you and you know, introduce themselves sometimes, or you can introduce them and you know you're comfortable with them. And some are just, you know, you have to be just a little careful about how you handle them, you know. I never ever went up to a major actor, you know, a big star, and with a script and say, you know, your lines are wrong, you've said something wrong. You always go up with a suggestion, you know, saying, you know, the script says this, do you want to say what you're saying now, or would you like to have a look at the script maybe? You know, you always sort of, you know, you have to sort of finesse them a little bit.
Yeah.
And most of them are really appreciative of that. Nobody likes to be told, and, you know, there are script supervisors who will go up to an actor and say, hey, this is the line, this is what you should be saying. They don't like that. You don't do that, you know. And some of them will say to you beforehand, sometimes I go off script, would you come and tell me if I have? And then, so you know how to do it, you know, okay, how to deal with that, you know. They're all so different. Some have big egos, some have no egos, you know. It's the new actors who are insecure and not quite sure where they are, who tend to be a little more demanding. Because I think the insecurity comes through. The experienced actors, you know.
Well, it's funny you say that. It's slightly different, but my dad is a black cab driver, and he would always say the huge stars that he's picked up are Michael Caine, Alan Rickman, are the ones that are chit-chat, you know, right, talk to you. Like, when you get the young upstart ones who are just famous, because they're the ones that are just a nightmare. Because, and it seems to be, for the most part, across the board that way, that they get this new celebrity and they think, this is how I have to act. Whereas the ones who've been in the business many years...
It's a lot of insecurity. You know, it's hard being an actor, especially, you know, a young actor. When you think you have to go through all this rejection, you know, the stuff that you have to go through, it's going to be so hard for them to get there, you know. Sometimes you have to respect that. It's not an easy job. And once you've made it, it's great. You know, then you can call the shots and it's not, you know, you can do a movie or not do a movie, you know, although they all love to act. So what can I tell you? Yeah.
Well, another talking about Jim Carrey's status, it was Mr. and Mrs. Smith, where he had two of the biggest stars in the world, which is Brad and Angelina. Now, I wanted to ask about an action film for you and continuity on an action film. Is that just, you really have to be eagle-eyed now what's the difference between a film that's very sort of action heavy and a film that's very dialogue heavy from your perspective?
That's a good question. I truly don't find a lot of difference because there are totally different types of shots that you're keeping track of. when it's dialogue, you're very dialogue intense, you know, and movement on dialogue and stuff like that. When it's action, it tends to be a little looser sometimes, you know, and action movies tend to be very well choreographed. You have a stunt man, a stunt coordinator, and he knows exactly what everybody's going to be at all times. So it doesn't make it hard for us. In fact, it makes it quite easy for us, you know. And that's really all I can say. I mean, it's not that big. I don't find it that big a difference. You know, if you have the right people, it's having the right people there. You know, you've got a good stunt coordinator. Every shot is planned. You'll generally find that when you do big action sequences, they do what's called a pre-vis. I don't know if they call it that in England. You know, where every shot is blocked out, so you know exactly what's coming. You know, it makes a script supervisor's job very easy.
And I guess half the reason for that is so that people aren't standing in front of a car rolling down a hill, or, you know, the safety aspect.
Well, that's true, yes. The safety aspect is very important, yeah. I always prefer dialogue movies myself. I love comedy. I love working dialogue movies. You know,
well, I was going to ask, is there a genre that is your favourite to work on?
Comedy.
Because they often say that with comedy films, it's the making of it isn't as funny as what we're looking at, and then the sort of real dramas are a hoot on set, but the, you know, the subject matter itself is very, could be very dark and gloomy and downbeat, melancholy, whatever, but making it was a real laugh. And the polar opposite of that is with comedies. But did you find that, or is a comedy set generally a happy set?
Well, most comedy sets are a happy set, but the tone of the set is set by the director, so it really depends on the movie itself.
Yeah. Right.
It depends on the director. You know, you can get a director like Joel Schumacher, you know. He's a fun person to work with and really nice. The sets were always, you know, in the Flatline, it was a sort of a very black sort of movie, a dark movie. But it was always a fun set. It was a great set to work on, yeah. So it's the tone of the set is set, as I said, by, and the director of photography too, who's a very important person. And he can sometimes be really terrific and sometimes okay.
So the different styles of director, are there directors that fully embrace you being on set and almost, you know, lean on you, please don't leave my side, and other directors who are very and I'm not going to ask for names, I'm just curious is it generally other directors that would just I'll give you a shout if I need you.
Yeah, yes, absolutely, absolutely. I find that sometimes with some directors, they just want somebody who wants to keep notes. You know, they don't really or keep an eye on the actors and make sure everything's going that way. Sometimes they just don't even want to hear from you. And then there are some who, yes, glue, you know, don't leave my side, stay with me, you know. I don't mind mentioning Howie Deutsch is one, because I worked with him so many times, and his focus has always been actors. It's always been actors. So he always relied on me and his director of photography, who, Tak Fujimoto, did quite a few of his pictures, to make sure that we got the coverage, to make sure we got the right shots, you know, for his vision of the movie. You know, so, yes, they're all different, definitely. You know, and I don't remember. I'm not going to mention all the names.
No. Sometimes
they're just glorified note takers. It's true. You get on a movie, you could be just, all you do is just stand there, as long as you get your notes done. And of course, now, of course, it's different because everything is digital. So everything gets done and transmitted to the editor right away. You know, we used to just, on our day, it was pencil and paper and then you typed your notes. So I actually had a computer towards the very end and put a lot of stuff into the computer and was able to send it towards the end of my career. But now everything is digital. They don't even use a script. They use a tablet, you know. And it's interesting. You know, it's a different way of doing things.
Yeah. Well, a couple of the credits, you mentioned that you weren't on the whole show, which was Miami Vice and Pirates of the Caribbean.
Right.
But
there was somebody else on. What happened is a friend of mine was doing Pirates of the Caribbean, and she had to go off for some reason or whatever. And I came in. I think I did it. We were finishing the second one and into the third one. So it was like a little bit of both. But I was there for about, over 2 months on it. And it went on forever. The big storm scenes where they rock the boats from side to side, that's where I was, but there most of that time, which was...
that's why she went, because she didn't want to...
Probably, yeah. And Johnny I know, you know, I knew Johnny from Blow, so, you know...
Oh, of course.
And he is one of the easiest and loveliest people to work with in the world. So, you know, it wasn't that hard. You know, I wasn't responsible for the entire movie, although I was absolutely responsible for what I did. But I think Sharon Enriquez was the person who really did most of it. Mr. and Mrs. Smith was the one that the director had problems with the script supervisors. We had, I think we had two or three before me when I came on. And then and it was an interesting experience. It really was. I mean, it was trying to keep the privacy of the actors was really very difficult because, you know, that was a time we all know when Brad and Angelina were getting together. And I mean, you should see the producers running around with great big sheets on C-stands, trying to hang them when we're outside. They would buy hotel rooms on either side of it. We were shooting in a lot, and they would buy the hotel rooms overseeing the lot so that people couldn't look in and take pictures.
Yeah. I mean,
that's it was incredible.
Yeah.
No, Miami Vice was fine. Miami Vice was, I came in towards the very end of that. Bit to end. Michael Mann, I found was, Michael Mann has, I know my son, Nicholas has done so many movies with Michael Mann. He knows him better than anybody else. I didn't work a lot with him, but he is a very demanding director, but if you give him what he wants, no problem. He's, you know, absolutely no problem at all. And actually, I liked him very much, and he recommended me for movies after that, so I guess we got on quite well.
Yeah, great. What would happen on a film then when you've got, so something like Pirates of the Caribbean, which is huge and has many units, you've got a second unit shooting. Do you have almost you have a first AD and a second AD. Do you have the equivalent with script supervisors?
Yeah, you try and have a second. Something as big as that, yes. You always have to have a second script supervisor because there's just too much to keep track of. You know, it's a big movie and so much going on. Yeah. And you try and, you know, if you're a first unit script supervisor and second unit script supervisor, if we're in the same area and not one's in Bermuda and one's in Los Angeles, we try to get together, you know, at the end of each day and you know, check notes and see what's been covered and how things are going. Yeah.
So you're the IMDb, as you explained to me via email, is when a film's released. So your actual last job before you retired was Tenacious D. And the Pick of Destiny.
God. What?
Well, in a way, I feel that kind of circles back to a Cheech and Chong
style. It does, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Do you know, you're absolutely right. Yeah. It does, doesn't
it's,
it?
It's
it
musical, it. It's that, and it's exactly the same sort of vibe. And, you know, part of Dave Grohl turn up as the devil at the end, but
right.
it really felt like a bookend. It bookended your career quite nicely.
It does kind of in a way, doesn't it? Yes. And it was a lovely movie. I know Jack Black was terrific and the director was wonderful. We had a really great time on that movie.
I didn't realize the director was Liam Lynch, who I only know from being a musician a few years ago. Yeah.
Yeah, he was a terrific guy. Really nice, really. Really, and it was fun. Yeah, there's no doubt about it.
Yeah. And mate,
it was kind of a bookend. You're right. It's true. A bookend it was. There's no doubt about that. Never thought of it that way, but that's a good way.
Well, there you go. So what are your fondest takeaways from your career? Now, you've plenty of time now to look back and think, what are the ones that, the nice memories that you conjure up from time to time.
Okay, the nice memories, I will tell you, well, some are personal, and some are not so much. Personal, of course, will always be Ferris Bueller's Day Off because I met the man I'm married to right now on Ferris Bueller's Day Off. He was a prop master. So that'll always be very special because we were both with different people. I was married to somebody else and he was living with somebody else and we had no idea. But we had an idea, let's put it that way. And Blow with Ted Demme and Johnny, who was the director, and Johnny. Ted Demme was one of the loveliest directors I've ever worked with. He just died so suddenly at a terrible, you know, just young age. He was so all-inclusive of everybody on the set. Before we even started shooting, I mean, I had met all the actors. So he invited a whole bunch of people for cocktails at the Beverly Hills Hotel. You know, all the actors, I was included. I mean, he was such just a generous spirited man and everything about him. And the people, and his producer, Georgia Kakandis, who was just amazing. She went on to produce, I think she's produced a couple of Scorsese movies as well. And Emma Tillinger Koskov, who was his assistant, is, you know, produced for, was Scorsese's assistant. So she's also a dear friend. That was really lovely. And And I really enjoyed working a lot on the John Hughes movies. I like working with Howie Deutsch, with Howie. Howie's a lovely man. He's a nice man. We had a lot of fun on the sets. You know, we had fun. You know, I think that's what's missing from filmmaking these days. When I talk to my son and what he goes through now, you know, when we made movies back then, it was like a big family. You know, especially when you went on location, like when we did Silverado. I mean, we were there for, I don't know, 5 or 6 months. Everybody was, you know, we were all, you know, we worked together. We had fun together. We went out the evenings together, you know, on Big Chill. I was there for Christmas, and I had Bill Hurt there and Glennie Close. We all spent Christmas together in my house that I'd rented on the beach. You know, there was such a camaraderie back then. And I think that's missing now from everybody I talk to, everybody I know now. That seems to have gone away. When Nicholas tells me that the producer doesn't know his name,
yeah,
it's unbelievable.
Yeah, he talked about that a lot on his episode.
It's unbelievable. We all knew, everybody knew everybody by first names. You know, I used to walk on the set and I felt I'm coming alive. I love this place. I'm at home. You know, it was just a great feeling when you walked on the set. And I don't know whether I feel the same this day anymore. You know, we had fun. We were able to play tricks on each other and do silly things like that. Now, you know, human resources gets involved, you know, and then you've got the bean counters back at the, you know, every penny they're watching all the time. You know, it's just a different attitude, you know. I mean, John Hughes, you know, you'd never be able to see John Hughes make a movie the way he made them back then today. I mean, they'd just cut back on him. You know, they wouldn't let him do what he wanted to do. I mean, John used to have on all his sets, he had a full kitchen because the assistant prop master used to cook for him. You know, he just says on every set.
Really?
Yeah. Do you think a studio is going to give that to somebody this day? There were different times.
Did it change and make it easier to retire for you? Okay, I'm happy with what I've done and I can see where this might be going now. Or was it tough?
Very, very tough to retire. My husband, who had not been well, had been retired for a while and really wanted me to retire. And I had reached an age where I thought, you know, I guess so. I still got work, not as easily as I did before. You know, I never had a problem getting a job before. You know? And yes, and it was changing. Things were changing. And I just sort of said, okay, I'll bite the bullet. It's time to retire. And I did. But the hardest part was when the phone would ring and say no. And you said no to somebody because, you know, you wait for the phone to ring because that's your next job. You know, you're freelance. That's what you do.
Yeah.
And saying no, no, no. And I know Taylor Hackford tried so hard to talk me back into doing something. And I kept saying, no, Taylor, I'm retired. I'm retired. And I said, and he said, well, it's only a movie a week. And I said, no. So I said, in any case, it's over Easter. And you're going to be back Easter. I'll fly you home for your family for Easter. I said, no. Thank you, Taylor. Thank you, but no, you know, I just had to stop. And I have no regrets now, of course, you know, but it was the first couple of years were really hard. Yes, they were really hard. But then, you know, I moved away from LA. We moved up here. We're out in the country. I have an acre of land. You know, we've got a nice big house. As I said, a nice big 4-bedroom house. It's comfortable. Traveled a lot until, of course, the pandemic hit. And stepping into that, but I'm going to Canada next week. A couple of weeks, and then beginning of August, I'm going to England for another couple of weeks. So I'm back on my I'm back on schedule.
Yeah, making up for with those 2 years. Yeah, but yeah. Well, Pamela, it's been an absolute joy to speak with you. Thank you very much for sharing your incredible stories and career. I mean, it's brilliant.
Okay.
Yeah, pleasure to meet you, Pamela. Thank you so much for your time.
And lovely talking to you. Thank you.
Where's your other hand? Between two pillows. Those aren't pillows. Ah! No! No!